The tarantella has a sort of appropriateness because although it's a rambunctious piece, it also is actually a dance of death. And we do have to remember that unfortunately, it's part of the plot, of course, Mr. Chips' story does not end happily. His wife and child do die during the proceedings. And that sense of tragedy linked with the cello has also been seen in much more contemporary history. Between 1992 and 1995, of course, the city of Sarajevo in Bosnia was besieged. And a recent novel, Stephen Galloway's The Cellist of Sarajevo, used that instrument to symbolize a much wider range of emotions in a story that was actually set during the siege itself.
Yes, that's right. I mean, this is supposed to be based on a true story, recounting events that happened in 1992. And the story is that this cellist, who actually was a professional cellist and worked at the opera house in Sarajevo, was at his, well, the way it's told in the novel anyhow, was at his window when he sees a mortar shell fall on a queue of people waiting to buy bread. And 22 people are killed. And so he takes his cello downstairs. It's this portability of the cello, again, that becomes so important here. And he decides to play. Then at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, 24 hours after the mortar fell on his friends and neighbors while they waited to buy bread, he will bend down and pick up his bow. He will carry his cello and stool down the narrow flight of stairs to the empty street. The war will go on around him as he sits in the small crater left at the mortar's point of impact. He'll play Albinoni's Adagio. He'll do this every day for 22 days, a day for each person killed, or at least he'll try. He won't be sure he will survive.
And again, if we think about the links to the most tragic and melancholy moments of the 20th century, one can't help but think of the teams of musicians, often string quartets and trios, that played in Nazi concentration camps during the Second World War.
Exactly. I have to say, a friend of mine knew one of them, and when she was a child, was always fascinated by the tattoo on her arm. And it is, you know, it is the melancholy sound of the cello that most poignantly and vividly evokes those difficulties and in some ways ameliorates them and in some ways makes a contrast which is actually, you know, even more painful because the to have that beauty injected into a scene of such horror means that the cello is the instrument for that purpose.
So perhaps the cello as the soundtrack of the more disturbing parts of 20th century modernity?
In many ways, yes, I think that's absolutely right. I remember once a critic saying to me, of course, this is why, after the Second World War, it was the low voices that people wanted to hear. You know, it was Kathleen Ferrier, it was Vera Lynn, it was the low voices that people needed because it was the voice of comfort, the voice of the mother. And that, in a way, exactly parallels this huge fashion for the cello.
I'm afraid we have to end the conversation here, but it has been a real pleasure. Thank you very much to my guests, Peggy Reynolds, Charles Martin, and Helen Crayford.
And that Proms Plus literary event was presented by Rana Mitter. The producer was Georgia Mann. And in next Tuesday night's Proms Plus literary event, Mark Ravenhill will be talking about the myth of Faust, one which has fascinated writers for centuries, with Matthew Sweet. Well, welcome back to the Royal Albert Hall for the second half of tonight's Prom, live here on BBC Radio 3 with me, Tom Service. We're going to hear a much belated Proms first, the first time in 117 seasons that one of the most original masterpieces of late 19th century music has been heard in full here. Bedřich Smetana's cycle of six tone poems, Ma Flast. Now, the most famous section of Ma Flast has been heard here rather a lot. No surprise given the brilliance of that fantastic fluid tune in the second tone poem, Vultava. I won't sing it for you now, but you'll recognise it immediately after about 15 minutes of the second half of tonight's concert. That's Smetana's evocation of the great river that flows through Prague, the Vultava. But there's much more to Ma Flast, my country, as you'd expect from a work that depicts the entire Czech nation in sound, its history, its battles, its spirit of independence, its myths, legends, and landscapes. It's music that's part of the beating musical heart of tonight's conductor, Jiří Bělohlávek.
In the second World War, in the time of occupation by German Nazis in Prague, the piece has been banned. And for instance, Mr. Václav Talich, who was at that time the music director of Czech Philharmonic, the Nazis has tried to bribe him and to get support from him, which he refused always. And one of this attempt was that he was invited with the orchestra to Berlin. And he did agree, because it was probably impossible not to agree, but he had the condition that they will play Smetana's My Country. And it had the consequence that afterwards the authorities, they had to allow to be played it in Prague as well, when it has been played in Berlin. So that was one of the moments when the piece has been very much regarded as a big support of the resistance and of the self-esteem of the nation and the belief that the better time will come again.
Tonight's conductor, Jiří Bělohlávek. Maflás then a piece absolutely at the centre of the Czech nation's identity. Well, Maflás begins with a mythic bardic sound, four harps, music that's a monumental evocation of the Vyšehrad, a castle on the Vltava River near Prague. And we'll hear that tune again at the crowning moments of the very final tone poem tonight, Glánik. But before then, there's that marvellous melody that starts the second piece, Vltava. Then comes the bloody matriarchal drama of the third section called Šárka, in which the heroine, Šárka, takes terrible vengeance on men, all men, for their infidelities, and a huge technicolour massacre in the orchestra. The fourth section, from Bohemia's Woods and Fields, I won't try that in Czech, starts with one of the most dazzling bits of orchestral colour ever written. A shimmering fresco for the full orchestra that's like walking through a lush Central European forest in dramatic sunlight. An absolutely, absolutely indelible moment. Then comes the two interlinked final sections, Dábor and Blanik, two battles that end, respectively, in inglorious defeat and then glorious victory. The BBC Symphony Orchestra, led by Andrew Havron, who's on stage already as they tune up, much expanded for this first full performance of Maflás. There are four of each of the woodwind players, there are more strings than usual, and four harps, where the score only really calls for two. So this is going to be a full surround sound performance of Maflás tonight. Jiří Bělohlávek was talking about the sense of Maflás being important in the 20th century for Czech identity, for Czech people. That's been true more recently too. In 1990, just after being freed from the Soviet yoke, Rafael Kubelik, the conductor, returned to Prague to conduct an unforgettable performance at the Prague Spring Festival of Maflás. So it's a piece that's symbolic of Czech identity throughout the whole, ever since its composition, and ever since its first performance in Prague in 1882. Well, here comes then tonight's conductor, Jiří Bělohlávek, to conduct the music of his homeland, Maflás.
Thank you. Thank you.
My Country, Maflast. The end of Smetana's cycle of tone poems, played complete for the very first time here at the Proms at the Royal Albert Hall. Jerzy Bielochlawek conducted the BBC Symphony Orchestra. Music of Jerzy Bielochlawek's Country, but really, we're all Czechs tonight. A fantastic reception in the hall for that music. Jerzy Bielochlawek conducted that piece, that whole 80 minutes of all six tone poems of Maflast from memory. Music he knows inside out, knows backwards. And what a huge play for this expanded BBC Symphony Orchestra. That music, that journey, that nation in sound is. Bielochlawek accepts this rapturous acclaim here at the Royal Albert Hall. Brings the orchestra to their feet. You know, if you can remember back to the way all this music started with Visegrad and the music for the four harps at the very start, one thing that Smetana does in Maflast, he only uses the harps in the first two movements. So, like the 6,000 of us here, they were mere spectators for the four succeeding tone poems. Still, not a bad place for them all to be, behind the first and second violins there, tucked in front of the timpani too. Jerzy Bielochlawek has another important position in Czech music, as well as being a strong advocate of the repertoire, not just Smetana, of course, but Janáček that I've heard in the first night of the Proms, Martinů, the set of symphonies that they've now released on record. But he takes up a position in 2012, next year, as the chief conductor of the Czech Philharmonic as well, in addition to his post here at the BBC Symphony Orchestra. Applause there for the BBC Symphony Orchestra, one of the heroes of that performance. The principal clarinetist, Richard Hosford, and the quartet of woodwinds there, the principal flute, Michael Cox, David Powell, oboe, and the bassoonist too, Graham Sheen. That wonderful moment at the start of Vltava, the most famous section of Maflast, Rob Cowan in his programme note describes how the two flutes represent the warm and the cold spring from which the river Vltava springs. Quite right too, Jerzy Bielochlawek bringing up the solo timpanist John Chimes and the four harpists, Shauna Williams, Manon Morris, Sally Price and Lucy Haslam. What life-affirming music that is, and just a wonderful thing about this Proms audience. In the front row of the Proms, gripping the railing, is a guy of about 6 foot two-ish in a black pull the neck, probably in his 30s. Next to him is a tiny wee woman, she must be in her 80s, and she has been in absolute raptures of smiles for the 80 minutes of that whole performance, gripping the thing, and she's giving Jerzy Bielochlawek the biggest salute of anyone here. Remember, you can enjoy all the Proms so far at bbc.co.uk/proms, all available to listen again for 7 days. But now, with this applause here at the Royal Albert Hall, time to hand you back to Broadcasting House and Ian Skelly.
Tom, thank you very much indeed. That was Tom's service at the Royal Albert Hall tonight with that Prom, which, as Tom was mentioning there, you can hear again by way of the radio on Friday afternoon here on BBC Radio 3 in our BBC Proms programmes in the afternoons. Every afternoon, a second chance to hear a Prom from the previous week. Tomorrow, for instance, there's a chance to hear that stunning performance of Stravinsky's The Rite of Spring, which was given by the Radio France Philharmonic Orchestra last night, conducted by Myung Hun Chung. The BBC Proms repeats are every afternoon from 2 o'clock here on BBC Radio 3. Or if you prefer, you can listen again anytime you'd like to for up to 7 days after they've been broadcast via the Radio 3 website.
The BBC Proms, a festival of extraordinary musical experiences.
From the 2011 BBC Proms, that most dramatic of choral works, the Verdi Requiem. Three choirs, four soloists, and the BBC Symphony Orchestra at the Royal Albert Hall. It's live on BBC Radio 3 on Sunday night from 7 o'clock.
Well, the time now is 10:10. A very good evening to you if you've risen to join us here on BBC Radio 3. Our next programme tonight is presented by Edward Sturton, who explores the life and the legacy of Cardinal Newman, whose beatification was made official by Pope Benedict in September last year during his visit to the UK. So, a profile of a very English saint in 5 minutes' time at 10:15. And a little later this evening, do stay tuned if you can to hear some pretty electrifying performances at the Latitude Festival, which took place in Suffolk last weekend. Max Reinhardt will be your guide to the music in Late Junction, which begins at 11 o'clock tonight. Music couldn't really get much more live than here on BBC Radio 3. I wonder if you heard the very first prom that took place last Friday evening and the very impressive debut of the 19-year-old pianist Benjamin Grosvenor playing one of Liszt's piano concertos. That's still available to listen to on the Radio 3 website if you haven't already heard it. Well, here he is now to take us to our next programme tonight in music by Chopin, A Nocturne. The Nocturne in C-sharp minor by Chopin. Well, we call it a nocturne, even though the man himself did not. It was played there by Benjamin Grosvenor, and I wonder if he's recovered yet from the exhilaration of making his debut at the Proms last Friday at the age of, well, very fresh 19. This is BBC Radio 3. It's 10:15. Well, last year, Pope Benedict XVI visited Britain, and one of the highlights of the trip was the beatification of Cardinal John Henry Newman, whose life spanned most of the 19th century. That's the penultimate step on the route to sainthood, and it would make Cardinal Newman the first non-martyred British saint since before the Reformation. Newman was once described as the most dangerous man in England. His religious faith took him from Protestantism to the Church of Rome, earning suspicion on all sides. He was a prolific writer and theologian who emphasised the role of the imagination and conscience. And today he's claimed by liberal and conservative Catholics alike. Even in death he attracted controversy, requesting to be buried in the same grave as his male companion of 32 years. A mystery still surrounds what happened to Newman's remains. Edward Sturton now examines the life and legacy of John Henry Newman.
In 1816, the 16-year-old John Henry Newman arrived here at Trinity College, Oxford, for the first time. He would have come in through Chapel Arch, which in those days was the main entrance to the college, into Durham Quad, a very intimate quad, which at that period was very much the heart of college life. The hall where the college would dine is just on my left, the library straight ahead, and the chapel on my right. It was the beginning of an association with Oxford that was to last for almost three decades. 1816 was a turbulent period in John Henry Newman's home life. His father's business had just gone bust. It was also a period of great turmoil in the Anglican Church. Geoffrey Rowell is an Anglican bishop and a leading Newman scholar.
There was anxiety because of the threat, as many English churchmen perceived it, to the identity of the church because of legislation that was being passed towards the end of the 1820s, relieving dissenters of disabilities, Catholic emancipation, and 1832, the Great Reform Bill, which had the effect of turning a parliament for which you had to be an Anglican in which to sit as an MP, and which of course was responsible for church legislation, into something which was no longer Anglican. Looking back, we can see it as the beginnings of the emergence of a more pluralist state and the crumbling of a confessional state. In addition to that, you have to look across the channel and the French Revolution, and was there going to be a similar revolution in England? And then, in a rather different way, the evangelical movement associated with John Wesley and Methodism, George Whitefield. If you ask about worship, it was often rather dreary, long sermons, very little in the way of anything which touched the heart, very little, perhaps, of beauty.
Newman secured a prestigious fellowship at Oriel College and very quickly found himself at the centre of the public debate about the church's future. He decided as a teenager that, as he put it, it was the will of God that I should lead a single life, and in 1825 he was ordained an Anglican priest. He became part of a group of Oxford dons and clergymen with like-minded ideas about renewing the Church of England, which they put forward in a series of pamphlets or tracts. The group became known as the Tractarians, or collectively, the Oxford Movement. It was based around the first of the tightly-knit circles of male friends, which were to be such a feature of Newman's life. Newman became the vicar of the University Church of St Mary in Oxford in 1828, and just before he took over the job, the interior of this medieval church had been redesigned to turn it into what's been described as a Calvinist preaching box, so everyone's attention in the church would focus on this raised wooden pulpit. And it was here that Newman really established his reputation as a preacher. Even on the page, his words have impressed people. The novelist Muriel Spark wrote in an introduction to a selection of his sermons, "It was by way of Newman that I turned Roman Catholic. Not all the beheaded martyrs of Christendom, the ecstatic nuns of Europe, the five proofs of Aquinas, or the pamphlets of my Catholic acquaintance provided anything like the answers that Newman did." And she, of course, had only read the words on the page. His performance was, by all accounts, electric.
One of the things that struck people most about him was his voice.
Father Ian Carr is a leading Newman scholar and biographer.
He had this low, thrilling musical voice which struck people. It's one of the things that struck them, was particularly when he preached. But people remembered that voice. It's echoed through the 19th century. People have intense memories of it.
So a sermon in St Mary's was a real event, was it?
Yes, the heads of colleges changed the dinner hour in order to try and stop undergraduates going, because the sermons were such a central part of the Oxford or Tractarian movement. Such was his magnetic personality that it was drawing young men into the arms of the Oxford movement.
What was the essence of that movement?
Well, the original motivation for the Oxford movement began with the state's interference in the church. So the question naturally that raised itself was, what is the church? That was a fundamental question for the Tractarians. And so they went back to the early fathers and began to rediscover a very Catholic conception of what the church is. Because the evangelicals believed, roughly speaking, the church was simply a sort of convenient place where people could get together and preach Christianity. And the main broad church party believed that it was simply more or less a department of state.
Newman's early Anglicanism was evangelical, and he was deeply suspicious of Roman Catholicism. He took the traditional Protestant view that Rome was corrupt. But when he visited the Eternal City for the first time in the early 1830s, he was in awe of its ancient splendour. He even reflected on the possibility of union between the Roman and Anglican churches, but dismissed it as a dream. On board ship on the way home, he wrote a hymn which evoked a spiritual journey. Newman's willingness to change his mind is one of his most appealing characteristics, and there's an especially attractive modesty of ambition about these lines: I do not ask to see the distant seen, one step enough for me. Lead Kindly Light has become a classic. It was also characteristic of Newman that he found the key to his future in the past. During the 1830s, he turned more and more to the study of the early Christian church, and as he immersed himself in the recondite world of 4th and 5th century theological debate, he saw the contemporary Anglican church reflected in history. He writes of an awful similitude between the dead records of the past and the feverish chronicle of the present. A phrase from the 5th century church father Augustine of Hippo suddenly struck him with, as he put it, a power which I had never felt from any words before. Securus judicat orbis terrarum. The whole world is the secure judge, Augustine declared. And to Newman that meant that the Anglican church, tiny in world terms, couldn't simply go its own way. John Cornwall has recently published a biography of John Henry Newman called Newman's Unquiet Grave.
Newman felt that church history teaches us many things about the church today. He saw this continuity between the church from the death of the last apostle right through to the present day. And he was looking for marks of continuity and the integrity of the church. And out of a particular historical incident, a particular heresy, he realized that the Church of England was in heresy. And this meant that his position as an Anglican was untenable.
The last of Newman's pamphlets on Anglicanism, Tract 90, was an attempt to overcome the barriers which divided Roman Catholicism and the Church of England. It was condemned by many of his former Anglican allies and friends, including his bishop, causing Newman great pain. Newman withdrew from Oxford to a small complex of stables and cottages he bought on the outskirts of the city at Littlemore. He established something very close to a monastic community, and the final act in the drama of his conversion was played out there. He was an alchemist with words, forging the gold of great prayer and poetry from his experiences. That's why he's still loved by so many ordinary believers, as well as the theologians who've studied his ideas. One of his best-known prayers emerged from this period of anguish over his parting with Anglicanism.
May he support us all the day long, till the shades lengthen, and the evening comes and the busy world is hushed, and the fever of life is over, and our work is done. Then, in his mercy, may he give us safe lodging and a holy rest, and peace at the last.
In September 1843, Newman resigned his post as the vicar of St Mary's the Virgin in Oxford. And later that month, he preached his last sermon at Littlemore. It was called The Parting of Friends. In the autumn of 1845, two of his companions at Littlemore were received into the Roman Catholic Church. Newman followed them on October the 9th. Father Ian Carr, Newman's biographer.
They were all in this position of being suspended between the Church of England and the Church of Rome, and one of them decided to seek admittance to the Church of Rome from this extraordinary figure, Father Dominic Barbary, a Passionist missionary who wandered around England in his habit and who had had this conviction when he was a shepherd boy in Italy that he was going to come to England and preach the Catholic faith. And so Barbary was arriving, so Newman thought, this must be the moment that's intended for me. So he asked Barbary to receive him into the church there and then.
It's difficult to overstate what a huge and indeed shocking thing it was for an Anglican clergyman to become a Roman Catholic in the Oxford of the mid-19th century. Newman did eventually come back to Oxford when Trinity made him its first honorary fellow in 1878, but for a long time he was estranged from this place which meant so much to him. I'm in the first rooms he occupied at Trinity. It's a pretty panelled set, but it was right at the back of the college and looked down on the college privy. Yet the view from these windows became, for Newman, a symbol of what he lost when he left here.
I left Oxford for good on Monday, February the 23rd, 1846. I called on Dr. Ogle, one of my very oldest friends, for me was my private tutor when I was an undergraduate. In him, I took leave of my first college, Trinity, which was so dear to me, and which held on its foundations so many who had been kind to me both when I was a boy and all through my Oxford life. Trinity had never been unkind to me. There used to be much snapdragon growing on the walls opposite my freshman's rooms there, and I had for years taken it as the emblem of my own perpetual residence, even unto death, in my university.
It was leaving a whole network of friendship and of church life, and who were you going to join?
The Anglican bishop and Newman scholar, Geoffrey Rowell.
Roman Catholics were very much a minority. On the one hand, there were the old Catholics, the recusant families, rather tightly knit, rather conservative. And on the other hand, the influx of Irish Catholics coming to look for work, not very sophisticated, not very intellectual. And then again, there was a strong strand of no-popery, anti-Catholicism, and, you know, to someone of Newman's subtlety of mind to have made that choice was really to go and join a church that many people thought was of the devil.
So much for the verdict of the world he was leaving behind, but what about the world he was joining? Archbishop Vincent Nichols is the leader of the Roman Catholic Church in England and Wales.
My impression is that Newman's arrival in the Catholic community was not easy, and it was difficult both for him, as he left his friends behind, and he suffered greatly because of that. And it was difficult, I think, for the newly established hierarchy to know what to do with this rather exotic figure. He was such an Oxford figure that I don't think it was easy for this emerging community, who were only just beginning to present themselves again in the emerging cities, out of the countryside, out from under the protection of the Catholic families in their houses. It wasn't easy to know how to relate to this man.
After his conversion, John Henry Newman travelled to Rome, and the next step on his religious journey saw him ordained as a Catholic priest. In Rome, he came to know the Oratorian order. Oratorian priests live together in small communities, usually in city centres. They're different from monks in the sense that they're very much involved in the world around them and don't take vows like poverty and obedience. Father Newman decided to establish the order in Britain. If Oxford was the stage where Newman's life as an Anglican was played out, this place, the Oratory in Birmingham, is most closely associated with his time as a Catholic. He came here in 1852 and lived here right up until his death in 1890. I'm in the library. It's a wonderful airy room, stacked with books from floor to ceiling, and I'm with the provost, who's Father Richard Duffield. Why did the Oratorian order attract Henry Newman?
He'd already been living a kind of religious life a little more with companions who became Catholics with him. Had they chosen the diocesan priesthood, they'd have been scattered to different parishes. Had he become a Jesuit, he might have been sent to some other part of the world. They'd have all been separated.
You're leaning rather nonchalantly on this magnificent wooden desk here. This has a special part to play in his story, doesn't it?
Yes, this is a stand-up desk. He stood at this desk to write. Especially, he wrote at this desk the Apologia Pro Vita Sua, his spiritual autobiography. Newman had been accused by Charles Kingsley, who was the professor of history at Cambridge and also, of course, the author of The Water Babies and Alton Locke. He'd written a review of James Anthony Froude's History of England. And in the review, Kingsley said that Dr. Newman assures us that truth is not or need not be a virtue with the Roman clergy. And so he felt he had to defend himself and defend the church. He wrote to Kingsley as one English gentleman to another. Kingsley wrote back and didn't really apologise. Then there was a short pamphlet war, Kingsley writing a pamphlet called What Then Does Dr. Newman Mean? And Newman wrote back very acidly, well, mean it, I maintain I never said it. And he realised that the only way he could really defend what he'd done in his life was by writing the whole history of his religious opinions. Because really what Kingsley was saying was, all the time you were in the Church of England, you were really a secret Catholic. And Newman had to defend himself against that charge by saying that he'd moved very slowly because there were authentic, real religious problems he had to work out in his own mind before he moved further onto the next stage. The book was published in serial form. From February to May 1864, Newman was writing at this desk for 16 or 17 hours a day.
Gosh.
And he writes in his diaries that it's amazing he could write any more to write a diary. My fingers have walked 20 miles over the paper today because he was just exhausted doing it. The printer's boy came on Thursdays. They took the manuscript down to the door, the ink still wet on the page. And of course the Apologia changed everything because Newman's power is that he doesn't just change people's minds, but by the power of his prose, he's able to change people's imaginations. And people could imagine themselves being affected and changed by these real religious questions.
This is the library where he wrote that great book. You also have downstairs the room where he lived, slept, said Mass, prayed. Shall we go and have a look?
Let's go.
And here we are. It's quite dark, the curtains are all drawn. There are bookshelves either side of the fireplace here on my right, and in the middle of the room, a desk with another rack of books. And this is exactly as it would have been when he died.
Yes, it's exactly as it was. We've dusted, but otherwise we've not done very much.
So as well as being a shrine to him, this is an insight into what life would have been like here in the late 19th century. There's a gas lamp on the desk, I see.
The lamps are fascinating. There are two of them on his desk. There's an oil lamp and a candle lamp. When I was a novice, and I used to give this guided tour regularly, we always said this small candlelight was given to him by Gladstone. But now I've noticed that the novices say that the large oil lamp was given by Gladstone. But, of course, Newman and Gladstone corresponded a lot. We have the letters still in our archives. They knew each other.
There's a screen up ahead of us, a wooden screen, with a crucifix standing on the bookshelf, and behind it I can just glimpse a sort of purple cap of some sort with a cross on top. What goes on behind the screen?
Well, I'll take you behind to show you, but it's quite interesting. An oratorian is given one room to live in for the whole of their lives, and it should be comfortable, it should be homely. But Newman's bed was behind that screen originally. When he was made a cardinal in 1879, the rule of the church at that time was that a cardinal who was not a bishop of a diocese had to reside in Rome. Newman wrote to the Holy Father to say, may I carry on living in Birmingham? May I have a dispensation? It was readily granted, so long as he lived in the state, becoming a cardinal. And so while he was away in Rome getting his cardinal's hat, he was given another bedroom. And I'll take you behind to show you the chapel that was fitted out.
So what was his bedroom became his private chapel?
Yes.
Oh, it's charming, isn't it? Tiny little
here
chapel.
It is. Tiny. It's tiny but perfectly formed. A little baldacchino, what you call the cap, is in fact a little velvet dome above the altar. We have Newman's chalices in these boxes.
A beautiful gold chalice.
That's right. I'm going to lend it to the Pope for the papal mass.
He's going to use that to say mass.
I hope so. I've not cleared that with his MC yet, but I think he'll want to.
It's a remarkable thing to have preserved this place. like this. What was the thinking behind that?
Well, I think there was a strong sense, even at the time of Newman's death, that this was a really remarkable man, possibly even a saint. And certainly here in his community, among the priests he'd lived with, they wanted to keep it as it was.
Just outside John Henry Newman's room is a very striking picture on the wall of two young men, both dressed in black, sitting at a table, both at their books, which are open in front of them. This is John Henry Newman
on the left,
Ambrose St. John, his close friend, on the right. And what were the circumstances in which this picture was painted?
This is painted almost immediately after they both became Catholics, and they are in Rome studying to become priests at the Collegio di Propaganda Fide.
Tell me a bit more about the relationship between them.
St. John was very much younger than Newman. He was the chap who was really with Newman, faithful to him all the time, from Littlemore right to St. John's death in the 1870s. And so I think Newman relied on him for all sorts of things, practicalities, for translations, for helping running the school. And they were soulmates in a certain sense, I think.
You've no doubt in your mind that it was a chaste relationship?
None whatsoever, no.
What do you make of the controversies there have been about it?
Well, I think it's very sad that friendship should always have to be eroticised, really, and to be seen in those essentially post-Freudian terms. Newman would never have seen things in those ways. He'd have been very shocked and scandalised to think it would have been seen in that way at all. I think it's a diminution of the power of real friendship, and anybody who has a real friend whom they've had for years, who knows them intimately, but with whom they're not in love in the physical sense, would be shocked by such an impoverished understanding of friendship.
The question mark over Newman's sexuality is not entirely a modern invention. Some of his contemporaries remarked on what they saw as his effeminate manner and appearance. John Cornwall.
Having read through most of the 32 great fat volumes of Newman's letters, one doesn't get much of a sense of sexual libido coming out. I don't think that he was interested sexually either with men or with women. I see the friendship with Ambrose as being an essential helpmate to him. After all, he was one of the really great writers of his age, a prodigious literary workaholic, and he needed somebody to help him through everyday life, somebody to rely upon. There was a deep emotional attachment, I think, but I think it's clear that it was absolutely non-sexual. Indeed, when Newman was criticised by one of his oratorium confreres for having a special friendship, Newman replied,
"As to particular friendships, I have much wished a definition of what it meant. St. James and St. John had a sort of particular friendship among the apostles, so must brothers in a congregation ever. That is, there must be feelings between them which are not between others. The point, I conceive, is that they should not show it, should not act upon it. To me now, the hopeless thing is this, that when the idea has once got into people's minds, it cannot get out. For if from circumstances I have been brought closer to Father Ambrose than to others, let me hide the fact as I will. I can do nothing to undo it. Unless I actually did cease to love him, as well as I do."
Newman was once memorably described by another prominent Catholic convert of the day, Cardinal Manning, as a great hater. But there's plenty of evidence of his talent for friendship too, with women as well as men. Melanie McDonough is a Catholic writer who used her newspaper column to join battle in the recent controversy over Newman's relationships.
And it's worth considering that he got on much better with his sisters than with his two brothers. He looked after his mother and his sisters, even though he was a don and a clergyman, after the father's death, when the family circumstances were very much reduced. The other female friendships were equally important to him. He had a great friend, Maria Gibbon. She was very beautiful, rather buxom, dark. One gets the impression of a slightly larger-than-life character. When they both went at one point to Rome to visit the Pope, Pius IX, and Newman kissed the Pope's toe, and Maria Gibbon grabbed his foot, and Newman said, rather laughingly afterwards, that he thought the poor old Pope was going to be knocked backwards. She seized him with such force. But because he'd turned his back on the idea of marriage, he was a very possessive person. He was jealous of his friendships in the old sense that he felt of them as his. And it was interesting that when his sister Harriet married Tom Moseley, who's a clergyman, he was upset about it. When his friends were lost to him through marriage, and he did very much feel that they were lost to him through marriage, that was something he resented because he felt, quite rightly, that once they were married, they weren't going to be available for those intimate friendships that they had been before.
Those old-fashioned Donish communities are marked very often by close friendships. They're also sometimes a bit catty, those communities. Did he show any symptoms of cattiness, do you think?
Oh, absolutely. Yes, his correspondence is littered with instances of barbed sort of wit and a good deal of waspishness. And it came out in particular episodes. There was one letter when he complained bitterly that one of the brothers had taken the cocoa, and he wrote at some length about his hopelessness in terms of the domestic environment. And at Edgbaston, at the community there, there was one poor chap who'd offended him in some way early on in their life together, and for 20 years Newman just caught him. He just didn't have a word to say to him thereafter, and the poor chap never quite knew what it was that had put his nose out of joint. But yes, he did have a capacity for slight queeniness, but that doesn't gainsay his other capacity, which was for a great openness in his friendships. He didn't believe in bottling it up.
I'm in what was Cardinal Newman's bathroom, where he took a cold shower every morning, and this room is now absolutely packed with piles of boxes, some of them hidden under plastic sheeting, one of them rather a tottering tower of boxes here under a cardinal's hat. And these, Father Richard, are the originals, if I understand it right, the originals of everything Cardinal Newman wrote here.
Yes, all 17,777 letters that we know about, all his manuscripts, they're all here in boxes waiting until we've built an archive so that they can be safely stored.
Could we look at a couple? I mean, this one, for example, I see archive box one. It's got written on the side, letter to the Duke of Norfolk, a reference that presumably to that very famous pamphlet in which he wrote about the question of conscience.
Let's have a look.
And there it is.
There it is.
That tiny, very, very neat writing.
Yes.
Beautiful writing. And the great quote from that letter is where he said, "Certainly if I'm obliged to bring religion into after-dinner toasts, I shall drink to the Pope, if you please, still to conscience first and to the Pope afterwards," which a lot of people have read as his rallying cry, if you like, for the importance of conscience.
Yes, of course, it's Newman's most famous soundbite, and it's often used as if Newman is being derogatory to the Pope. I don't think the two are mutually exclusive. We can't work out our faith for ourselves by the natural light of human reason. We need revelation. We need the Church. And in some sense, we need the authoritative teaching of the Pope to guide us.
Father Richard Duffield, the provost of the Birmingham Oratory, touching on one of the most controversial aspects of Newman's thinking. Newman the convert was a great trophy for the Vatican and the newly established English Catholic hierarchy, but his ideas often brought him into conflict with the church authorities. One Vatican Monsignor called him the most dangerous man in England. He was a champion of the role of lay people in church life, and he had doubts about the decision to declare the doctrine of papal infallibility in 1870. Partly because of those views, he had a distinctly scratchy relationship with Cardinal Manning, who led the English church from 1865 until his death in 1892. Archbishop Vincent Nichols has Manning's job today.
He was quite clear that there needs to be a point of authority. But towards the end of the Apologia, the imagery he uses to describe the role of infallibility is really very dramatic. He takes his imagery from the Industrial Revolution that's taking place at the time. So he refers to the smelting of iron, which is a very dramatic process. And he says the exchange between our reasoned human nature and its quest for truth and the infallible magisterium of the Church is like that.
It is the custom with Protestant writers to consider that whereas there are two great principles in action in the history of religion, authority and private judgment, they have all the private judgment to themselves, and we have the full inheritance and the superincumbent oppression of authority. But this is not so. Catholic Christendom is no simple exhibition of religious absolutism, but presents a continuous picture of authority and private judgment, alternately advancing and retreating as the ebb and flow of the tide. It is a vast assemblage of human beings with willful intellects and wild passions, brought together into one by the beauty and the majesty of a superhuman power. into what may be called a large reformatory or training school, not as if into a hospital,